In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. We continue to explore prominent covert harassment cases designed to slowly deteriorate quality of life and isolate a person from friends and family. Our guest this week is Debbie Johnson. She was born and raised in Oklahoma. Sightings of cryptids and paranormal events haunt her early memories. Debbie's family later moved to New York City, and the related strangeness ended while living in an urban environment. But when she moved to Hawaii for a position in military intelligence, strange, hard-to-dismiss events picked back up. However, it was when Debbie moved to Orange County, California, that organized stalking began in full force. We follow Debbie's timeline and chronicle some of the overt organized stalking experiences that have plagued her life. We'll also venture back out on a limb and talk with Debbie about related paranormal events she and her husband experienced. Debbie now joins us to talk about her organized stalking case. Debbie, welcome to Another News.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, Debbie, you were talking with past guest Josephine Grace, who lives in Missouri, about an encounter with a gang stalker that she had photographed and posted on her website, targetedartist.wordpress.org. And you had seen the same gang stalker. Could you start from the beginning and explain what happened?
My husband and I had taken a trip up to the Ozarks to visit family and friends. So in our travels, we decided to stop in my college town of Joplin, Missouri. We had stopped at we had stayed at a hotel in Joplin overnight. And I have a service animal, so we keep her with us. And we decided to go get something to eat that was close to the hotel. Upon coming back, I noticed when I got in the room, there was a blood stain on the toilet paper roll and a blood stain on my cold cream container. I thought, this is odd. The cat was underneath the bed. Didn't mean she was scared enough, and she always does that when she's in a new place. And we inspected her paws to see if there was any kind of cuts. Maybe she had cut herself on the bed spring or something. Nothing. Clean as a whistle. And I thought, that's really quite bizarre. So I tore off that piece of toilet paper. And in my opinion, now looking back on it, they wanted to know, we know where you're at. Someone had access to that room. Later that night, someone tried to get in the room. And it was about 10 o'clock when we came back from dinner. It was an older lady, probably in her 80s, very confused. I don't know if that was coincidence or she was sent to do that. But it kind of freaked me out because I'm like, why is someone accessing my room? Well, she couldn't get in because it wasn't the right room number. So my husband told her, you know, you're probably going to have to go back to the front desk and make sure you got the right room number. So we went to bed, left the next day, and the whole blood thing kind of creeped me out. So we left and we went into Springfield. And we have family and friends there, so we decided to visit with them. And as soon as I got into Springfield, I felt of a malevolent energy in that town that I had not felt in a long time. So we decided to go to a local fusion Asian restaurant. I don't know if the couple was there before we got there or afterwards. I can't remember. At that time that we were traveling, I was having serious stomach issues. So if I was in pain, I wasn't paying any attention to anyone around me. Then I noticed that the couple in front of us, a blonde-haired white woman and the man I saw on Josephine's site, talking very loud. And I thought, this is very odd for people to talk this loud, especially about their personal business in front in a restaurant. We were the only two couple there because it was like around 11:30, 12 o'clock. And I thought, how weird that they're talking so loud. It's like they want me and my husband to hear what they're saying. So after we finished dinner, or lunch, I went into the restroom, and my husband said, while you were in the restroom, the woman was talking to the man, and he said, quote, I've got two or three more jobs to finish for these people, and they're going to expunge my record. And she said, quote, well, you're doing a really good job. You're going to be okay. And I made eye contact with the both of them, as I was looking at them like, why are you talking so loud? And I looked right directly at him, sat down, and her, so I had a pretty good clear picture of them. So we sat down, The lady brought us our check, and we paid for it, and we left. We decided to go back to Arkansas because I was spooked out by Missouri. I just didn't feel comfortable in that state. It just, something was completely off. It's like my inner Akashic records was telling me, leave. So we go back to Arkansas where we stayed before, and I forgot to mention this in the email I sent you. As soon as we got there, there were two African-American men, two cars down, and they were smoking weed in the room. And it was so pungent, it was gagging. And I thought to myself, why are they being so obvious about smoking weed in the room? They got the door wide open. And when I went back into my room, I asked my husband if he smelled it. He goes, yeah, it almost knocked me over. So I went in back into the lobby, and I asked the clerk, I said, is it legal to smoke marijuana in your room here? Well, no. I said, because you got two dudes to the right of me that are, the air is so thick, I'm about to get high off the octane air. Well, I'll talk to their supervisor, not I'll call the police, nothing. So the supervisor allegedly talked to them, and the entire night they were back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I don't know if this was gang stalking or if they were making deliveries, if you know what I mean. So after we got into the room and had that encounter with those two men, they didn't say anything to us, but they both gave me and my husband a glare, you know, like, mind your own business. So we go to the Big Blue store to get some groceries for the night. I didn't feel like eating out that night. My stomach was bothering me. And I'm in the pet aisle, and I saw the man from Springfield. So he had followed us from Springfield to Arkansas. And I looked right at him. I thought, oh, my God, you can't be more. This can't be happening. So I ran over to my spouse, who was at the other end of the store. I said, that dude in the restaurant is here today. He goes, you got to be kidding me. I said, no. And so I walked around and followed him. So I'm basically watching the watchers. And he was over by the deli aisle, and I cornered him with my cart, and so did my husband. He said, nice to see you again. And the guy was on the phone, and he didn't know what to say. He had that deer in the headlight look. And he mumbled back to my husband, nice to see you again. And he pushed his cart away and walked out of the store, completely left. So that was no coincidence. So then a few days later, I'm looking at Josephine's site. Because I had found out about her off the Don Croft site about targeted artists. And I thought, well, I'm going to check this woman out. She lives in Springfield. We were there. Let's see what her blog is all about, what she's going through. So I'm scrolling through her pictures, and I thought, oh, my God, that's that same man. The same man. And I yelled out, you got to come over here and look at this guy's picture. I said, this is the same guy. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's definitely the same one. It was on Josephine's site. I put a small comment on her site that was real inconsequential, and she emailed me back, and then we started talking. And I told her, I said, that dude that you got on your site is the same man that followed me from Springfield to Arkansas. What's the likelihood of seeing him in the restaurant and then seeing him in the Big Blue store? Slim to none. And I've just had a habit of always confronting them in the past. When they were gang stalking me in California, I confronted people. I confronted a cop that was following me. I came right out and asked him why he was following me. And he looked at me and he said, I'm not following you. I said, baloney. Every time I'm somewhere, you're there. Why are you following me? And he wouldn't answer me. But once I confronted him, I never saw him again.
Don Croft was a proponent of that tactic as well. Now, Debbie, when you were at that restaurant with listening to the loud conversation, this is something that a past guest, Carissa Conti, writes about in her book, Chasing Phantoms. She writes, I've read or personally heard from targets describing gang stalkers preemptively positioning themselves. These are the gang stalkers. They'll preemptively position themselves at whatever place the target is going, which they shouldn't have any way of knowing about, and then saying weird, random, quote, street theater comments to them. Or in other instances, the stalkers will have loud conversations among themselves, making sure that the target can hear them saying things that directly relate either to the target's personal life or thoughts that they also should have no way of knowing. Then there's the everyday, quote, fill in the cracks, maddening behavior that have been reported, where the stalkers supposedly begin coordinating their seemingly innocuous actions with the target's car horns and car alarms, door slamming, sirens kicking in, people coughing or stomping, banging around, as in the cases of neighbors or upstairs apartments and condos, things like that. In the restaurant, remind me what they said?
He told her, he said, I've got two or three more jobs to do, and they're going to expunge my record. So I'm thinking he had a felonious record, and if he stalks people like me, my husband, and other innocent people, and reports back to whomever he's reporting to, they'll expunge his felony record. But as we all know, those are never expunged. There's always a file on you somewhere.
You had mentioned that some of the gang stalkers, the lower level people recruited for organized stalking, come out of prison.
Yep. They come out of prison. They tell them they're going to expunge their records. And then they give them a list of people to follow. Probably they pay them in gift cards. And I've heard this before. And working prior to this in payroll and accounting, gift cards that they're paid for in cash are untraceable. But see, when they give them gift cards, they register those gift cards on the master server so they know what you spend at Target or what you spend at Starbucks. So they know where you're at all times, the perp. So the perp is being recruited a lot from prison. I'm wondering now if that's why the current administration is letting so many of these felons out, not because of misguided altruism, but as an arm of the deep state. So when they follow you for 3 or 4 months or whatever, they work for the machine for about 3 or 4 months, and then they kill you because you know too much. And it's, you know, I meant to tell you, I forgot to tell you, the night that we talked, the last time we talked before we scheduled this interview on the phone, I'm sitting out on my front porch, and there's no street lights here at all. I'm in the woods. And all of a sudden, this weird light is across the street. I don't know if it was a scope light, a directed energy light, but it spooked me bad enough that I ran in the house. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. And so, like I said, I don't know if it was someone standing there with a scope rifle light or a directed energy weapon, but it spooked me bad enough. I was up all night thinking about it. So then the next night I came outside, and it was super dark because it was the dark of the moon. And I didn't feel an energy or presence out here, but I just said out loud, hey, you gang stalker, if you think you're going to hit that directed energy weapon towards me or a rifle scope, I got a big kill-tip arrow ready for you. And I haven't had any more situations since then.
Could be people in the invisibility suits, do you suspect?
Yes, or something. But it was really weird, Jeff. I've never seen nothing like that before. It was probably 6 or 7 feet off the ground. It looked like a flashlight, but nothing behind it or in front of it. Because, you know, a flashlight will send like a tunnel light towards your house. This is like a beam. Now, it could have been a ghost. It could have been an orb. Who knows? But it really freaked me out, and I don't spook that easily. And I ran in the house like a bat out of you know where. And I shut the door, and I wouldn't go back outside.
It's amazing what you've exposed. The same gang stalker you confronted in Walmart, and you told Josephine it was the same one? And what did she say?
I don't think she was surprised, because he probably has a wide net of where he goes. He probably, his territory is probably Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas. I'm sure that he doesn't go past those four states. It'd be too expensive to send him all over the place. Although the deep state has unlimited funds, as Catherine Austin Fitz has talked about with the black ops budget. Most of them are cowards. I find most of them smoke. You know, like I said, they've got something on them. If you're a gang stalker, they've got something on you. They've got a control file on you, like just like they do the politicians or these large corporate heads that get out of line. Hey, we got that film about you, you know, and so they keep them in line. They may have that on Trump. Who knows? Because he's a completely changed person than when he was elected. So they either have something on him, he's a clone, or I think it's the former. They may have something on him. So I believe that's why they let all these prisoners out of jail, to use them. It's not a matter of altruism. So if you're in prison and you get out and they support you, they approach you, say no. Just pay the $50 every month to your probation officer, lead a good, clean life, and stay alive.
Yes, it's not worth torturing other people. In the end, as you pointed out, some of these people, they get killed.
Yeah, and if they're from like Chicago or Indianapolis and they've got a prior drug record, they just shoot them, dump them off on probably some abandoned street in the big city, and when the cops finally find their body and DNA them, oh, that was John Doe. He was a former druggie. He probably just got killed in the gang war, not knowing that it was the deep state that probably whacked him. No, I found that when you confront them or talk out loud to them, it spooks them because they're not used to you confronting them. They are used to a docile, servile American man or woman, because the American man or woman had been so dumbed down and so beaten down and so docile, whether it's medication, poor diet, you know, pharmaceutical drugs, they just say, you know, yes, sir, can I have some more, please?
Agreed. Thanks for those insights. Debbie, I want to look at your timeline, if we could, from a perspective of some of the first gang stalking events that occurred. You were born in Oklahoma and then moved to New York City. While there, it was pretty quiet, but things started to resurface in Hawaii. Could you give listeners some background here in terms of what year this was and some prominent events that occurred in Hawaii?
Well, when I lived in Hawaii, I wasn't really bothered that much, except for when I went to work for the military branch in Honolulu. And it was a federal job, but I was a temp. And I worked there for about a year. And while I'm working there, the man that was my boss, probably a decade older than me, because I'm in my 20s then, would call me at home at night. And after like a few weeks, my then late husband asked me, he said, who are you talking to? What man are you talking to on the phone? I said, it's my boss. He goes, why is he calling you here at home? I don't know. He just wants someone to talk to. I was very naive back then, Jeff. I had no idea what was going on. And so then finally, I think maybe the third week he called, my husband answered the phone and said, why are you calling my wife at home? Don't you get to talk to her enough at work? Stop calling here. And it was right after that I got fired.
When you were fired, did the gang stalking occur afterward?
No. In fact, about 6 months later, one of the high officials, his secretary, called me and said, we're sorry about what happened to you. We wish we'd have known what happened. We'd like you to come back. And I said, no, thanks. I said, I don't want to get fired again and go to round two. I've got a job I'm really happy with. It was a few years later that we left the islands because I just didn't like Hawaii, to be honest with you. And my late husband liked it, but I didn't. So then we came back to California, and then he died there about a year after we came back. He died in a car crash.
Debbie, we should mention that your late husband was in the military, and was he in military intelligence?
Yes.
And that's a key factor as well. Past guest Carissa Conti had emphasized those in military intelligence and their families are often subjects of organized stalking.
After he died, the weirdness began. But, you know, I don't even know why they followed me, because I don't know anything, to be honest with you. He never told me anything. He was debriefed when he left that he couldn't talk about anything that he had witnessed. And so right after he died, about, I'd say it was a week later, I went back to work, and my neighbor upstairs told me, he said, some dude is coming by your house in a black Mercedes and banging on your door. And I said, like an FBI-looking kind of guy with a suit? He goes, yes. And so this man kept waking my neighbor up because he worked the graveyard shift. Finally, he went down to the first floor and said, why are you bothering her? She's not here. She's at work. Her husband just died a few weeks ago. Why are you here? And the guy wouldn't respond to my neighbor, and he just took off. And they kept coming by, and finally the resident manager was home that day and said the same thing. She's at work. Her husband just died. I don't know why you're here. If you've got an issue with her, leave me your card, and I'll have her call you. Never did. And so pretty well stopped after my landlord confronted him. And then, but he took down the license plate number of the car, the make, and what that guy looked like. And I'm pretty sure he took a picture of him. Anyway, because he said, I have a picture of him. If he comes by again, I'm going to call the local police or sheriff because he's harassing you or harassing the complex because this is private property. It pretty well stopped after that. And then a few years later, I moved to a new apartment because I wanted to just kind of start fresh. And I'd been in that apartment a couple of weeks. And my new neighbor said, you know, while you're at work, there's men in your house. I said, what? She said, I can hear them talking and moving around things. I said, you got to be kidding me. Immediately thought it was my landlord and the crew. So I banged on her door mad. No, I would never come into your place unless I gave you a 24-hour notice. We can't. So I put that to rest. So finally, what I did is I started putting duct tape, like a leopard pink skin duct tape on my door. That way they would have had to break the seal to get in my house. Because I would come home and I'd smell cigarette smoke. I don't smoke. And so finally, after I started putting the duct tape up there, they stopped coming by the house. But right before I left California, when I moved out of there 13 years later, They took my immunization records and my genealogy records.
Did you ever find out who was it that was coming to your first apartment?
No. In fact, my neighbor said they were so quiet she never heard them coming, which meant they could have came into my back door, but they would have had to climb over a large fence for my patio. So they probably just picked a lock in the front door and was just very stealth about it. But she said she could hear at least two men talking. She could hear them talking, but she couldn't hear what they said. I mean, she literally said she put a glass up against the door to see if she could hear them, and it was nothing. But when I would come home, nothing was moved around. So I think maybe they thought that my dead husband maybe left stuff with me or came by. I have no idea. It was really freaky to know that someone had come to your house and ruffled through your stuff. They didn't steal anything, but they did take my immunization records and my genealogy records that I had had printed out from Ancestry.com because I couldn't find them before I left. And I was so upset because I wanted to keep those records. And those were all gone.
In your opinion, what is the significance of them taking those records?
I don't know. I can't figure that one out.
If they are with the government or with some shadowy group, then they would have access to the same information. They wouldn't have to take your hard copy.
That's exactly right.
So it is kind of odd. You mentioned that you had about 36 gang stalking events in California. It really was off the chart here. And some of them include a bait car. Some listeners may not know what that is. Could you describe that situation that occurred?
The bait car is, there's a show on, I forgot what network, where they put a brand new car in the middle of the urban areas to bait people into stealing it. And it was Christmas Eve, 2009. I had not been feeling good because I'd had the real bad flu, and I'm going to go into why I was feeling bad after this. There's a blue Volvo, brand new, had the tags on it, but you could tell it was probably a 2009, 2008 version. It's a four-door, sitting in front of my apartment complex on the public parking. And I just happened to see it because I was on my way outside to take out trash. I thought, that car door's open. Is someone in trouble? So I walked over. Car door was open. The dome light was on. And on the passenger side was a brand new Garmin GPS, a brand new pair of Oakley sunglasses, and you know how expensive those are, and a BlackBerry. Well, back then everyone had BlackBerries before the smartphones. Nice, nice BlackBerry in a case. I thought, this is bizarre. Why are they leaving this in the passenger side of the car? Someone's going to steal that. So I thought, well, maybe someone's just dropping off presents and they were in a hurry and they left the passenger door open. It was kind of weird. So I just went back into the house and, you know, did my routine for the day. And about 4 o'clock that afternoon, I'm on my way to Costco. And I walk outside and I said, that door is still open. So I walked over and the dome light was out, so the battery is probably dead. And I called the county sheriff because they ruled my area instead of the local police. And I said, I have a car in front of me that has expensive stuff in the passenger side because stuff was still there. And the door wide open. Is this car stolen? Well, give me the tag number. So I give her the tag number. She didn't answer me. Two police officers will be out. They come out about maybe 5 minutes later, and the one was very rude to me. Like, how dare you bother me? I said, well, I could have just left the car here and let it get stolen. Would that be okay? Or let someone steal the stuff out of the car? No, 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 the other cop said, you done the right thing. So he shut the car door with his hand. It was gone by street sweeping day. Now that I look back on it, that bait car was to bait someone into stealing stuff out of there, maybe me or anyone else in that neighborhood, and then they have you on camera stealing that stuff. Well, we won't put you in jail, and we won't arrest you if you do this for us. And I already smelled a rat when I saw the stuff in the car. I said, if it's too good to be true, it usually is. Not that I even thought of taking it, but I knew it just was just too weird. About 3 weeks later, the same car's in front of my house. But all the doors were shut. There was nothing inside. And I'm walking outside, and I'm looking at the car, and all of a sudden, an Asian woman is walking across the street. She looked like a typical FBI agent. You know how the women wear those pantsuits? I said, hey, you, I got to talk to you. Do you own that car? And she had fear in her eyes. I mean, she got this buggy look in her eyes. She got in the car with the keys. She tore out of there because she was parallel parked. She almost hit the car behind her and in front of her getting out of there.
Maybe not necessarily FBI, but very sketchy. And thanks for describing one of many incidences that occurred while you were in California. What would be another prominent event that occurred, Debbie?
Right around Thanksgiving, I started getting involved with the Tea Party. And because several of my Tea Party friends, this is when it was really first starting this initial phase, were getting followed, and one had a man sit in front of her house for a long time. And he said he was taking pictures for a realtor company. Well, her husband chased him off and told him he'd better get out of there or he was going to take a baseball bat to his car. So he left. It was a Middle Eastern-looking man in a brand-new car himself. Right after that happened, I had went to an event that was a Tea Party rally, and we were all sitting down at a hotel having a dinner. A man from the group, he was an ex-Afghanistan war vet, bought all of us dinners, like a dozen of us. There were two men there. One was harassing a group of women, and I, being like the, trying to be Wonder Woman, defended those women's honor. And he and I were going back and forth for about maybe 5 minutes, and Secret Service came up and pulled him away. And my friend said that the whole time we were arguing, you could have heard a pin drop in that entire room. So I'm sitting down, because I'm not driving that night, my friend is, and the waiter walks over and said, "That man over there with his wife, see them?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "He wants you to have a drink." He said, "You can have anything you want." And him and his wife gave me a thumbs up. I don't think they were gang stalkers. I think they were truly sympathetic, me, taking up for these women. A couple of days later, I became violently ill, and so did my friend. And I literally hurt so bad that I would sit in my rocking chair or my recliner and cry. Right around the time that I went to that event, I was okay, but right after that event, I was very sick the whole month of December. The beginning of the year, we went to another event in Orange County, and a man called my landlord. She said he sounded like he was in some kind of an office and said, "Does Debbie still live there?" And the landlord said, "I'm not going to confirm or deny that. Who is this?" He goes, "Is Debbie still living there?" with a very authoritative voice, and she hung up on him. And when I got home from the event, she had this ashen pale look on her face. Like, "What are you doing? What's been going on?" I said, "I just went to a political rally." "Okay. Well, someone called here for you, and it freaked me out." 2 or 3 days later, I got violently ill again. And I looked back on it, and I saw the same symptoms with anthrax poisoning. I was very ill. I lost over 20 pounds. I couldn't eat. I was very, very ill. And I'm in a vitamin store one day because I finally had enough strength to go into town. And I talked to a man who was a retired doctor, and he looked right at me and looked in my eyes. He said, "You've been poisoned." He said, "I want you to start taking 10,000 units of vitamin C crystals a day to get this out of you. I want you to go over to this juice bar, and I'm going to order what I want you to have. It's called the Cold Killer." He said, "It's a special recipe." He said, "I want you to get it, drink it, and go home." So I went over and I got the Cold Killer. It had all kinds of vile tasting stuff in it. I started sweating like a pig. My whole clothes were soaked, like I had been in a rainstorm. I went home and I slept. I took a shower and slept. And by the next day, I started feeling better. But for about 2 months, I was very, very ill. And my one friend that was with me at that event was in so much pain, she would call me crying. And it was really bad for a long time. Like I said, I lost about 20 pounds because, Jeff, I couldn't eat. And I had saw people that I hadn't seen for months, and they were like, "What happened to you? What happened to you?" And right after that, I made my plans to leave California. I said, "They don't want me here. They don't want me involved. It's too expensive to live here. I'm running out of money. I can't find work. I'm just going to leave." And then I did. But during the time that I lived in California for 20 years, I've been followed by cops. I've had loud and weird, noisy neighbors. I've had people turn on me for no reason, like a friend. And when I tried the online dating thing, which attracts a lot of psychopaths, I was stalked by a couple of different men that I had almost thought about leaving California then. They wouldn't stop calling. They wouldn't stop coming by. I had to make a police report on one because he wouldn't stop coming by my house.
Debbie, let me jump in there for a second and confirm that two past guests that have been on discussing their organized stalking case, very intense cases, both started with meeting their gang stalker or the source of their gang stalker on dating apps.
I had one that was mad at me that I wouldn't go out with him again. So he cut and pasted my picture and put me on the hooker site of Craigslist. And I didn't check my email for like a couple of days because I didn't have access to Wi-Fi at home at that time. And I went online. I had 400 emails from vile, disgusting emails from men. And so I contacted Craigslist. I deleted all the emails. I wasn't even going to read them because it would upset me too much. And I contacted Craigslist. They killed the ad. About a week later, he did it again. So Craigslist said, I think you should file a police report. Here's the IP address of the man that did it. We're going to ban him for life from AT&T because we do not condone this type of behavior. And you might want to file a police report against him. So the cop came to my house, and he was kind of weird, too. Like, I don't know what the damage is. I said, well, let me ask you, if your wife or girlfriend, their picture was placed on the hooker side of Craigslist, do you think you would like men emailing your wife or girlfriend all these vile, disgusting things? Well, no. Yeah, I want to file a police report. Mm-hmm. So he gave me another. Nothing ever come of it. I never heard anything more, but that harassment stopped. And that was from Craigslist. And I said, well, we're going to ixnay this. Because all too many times, I met some really nice men. But, I mean, far more often than not, they were just weird.
Yes, it seems to be an important vector for the inception of organized stalking cases. One of them was Katie, who it was suffering and is still suffering from voice to skull, and then Susan Conley out in Virginia. She actually lived in California as well. She was on the dating sites in California and met this person from Texas and moved out to Arizona, I believe. But ultimately, that was the inception of the organized stalking. Sorry to hear that you were getting targeted and violently sick and your health was at risk. Were there any other prominent events that you would share with the listeners that occurred in California?
Well, when the sheriff's department, or it wasn't really the sheriff, it was the local PD, which had no jurisdiction in my area. I don't know how that started, to be honest with you. It's probably because I was talking to some prominent people in these political movements, and I'm not going to say their name to protect their safety, but I was on the phone with one in a parking lot of Ross Dress for Less. That day that I pulled in, because you can't talk while driving in California, you'll get a ticket, so I stopped and took the call, and I parked in the parking lot. The parking lot's dead. I think it was like Super Bowl Sunday, so everybody was watching the game, and I'm looking for closeouts. And I'm in the parking lot, and a cop pulls right up next to me, young guy, and he just sits there. Nowhere else to park but me, were right next to me. And I'd seen this guy before, and I suspected he was following me because he followed me from a surfer event. So I walked right over to his car, and I said, hi. Hello. What are you doing? What do you mean, what am I doing, ma'am? I said, why are you following me? Well, I'm not following you. I'm just here to get dinner. I said, you, as a police officer, the majority of you who are completely lazy, are going to walk all that way to the Greek restaurant to get something to eat? Well, yeah, I thought I would just sit in the middle of the lot. I said, just right next to me, huh? I said, is there anything you want to know? You want me to tell you who I was talking to on the phone? Do you want my age and date of birth? Well, I can find that out from your car tag. I said, aha. I said, is there anything else you want to know? If I have a boyfriend or if I don't have a boyfriend, what I eat for breakfast? I said, because your handlers that are sending you obviously want to know what I'm doing. So just ask me right now. And he looked down. He wouldn't talk to me at all. He goes, I got to get dinner, ma'am. I said, you do that. So he goes to the Greek restaurant, gets his meal, and he sits there and eats it the whole time. So I just sit in the car because I thought, I'm going to outlast this guy. And he's looking over at me, and a couple of times he would wave, and then he finally left. So I outlasted him. Probably a couple of days later, I'm on my way to another store, and it's a one-way that you can only make a left. And I'm at the stop light, and I hear a honk, honk, and it's him waving at me. And at that time, I said, that's it. If I see him one more time, I'm going to the police chief. I'm sick of this. Why is he surveilling me? I'm like 20 years older than him, so it's not like he's looking at me as a love interest. Why is he following me? And at that time, if they were listening to me in my car or my house, they might have just said, leave her alone because she's on to you. And I never saw him again. But a normal cop would have kind of gotten combative and confrontational. He may not even have been a real cop. Who knows? But he said that he was quite demure and mellow, unlike the police officers of today and even back then. So I don't know why he was following, maybe to surveil me because of my political viewpoints, but it doesn't even matter if you're the left or the right. If they don't like what you have to say and what you're involved with, they'll follow you.
Also, I noticed that in some of the cases examined on the show, the guests are empathic or have a unique communication with the natural world. And Debbie, you have a psychic ability. Would you tell listeners
yes.
about this? Has it been helpful in picking up that you're being surveilled, for example?
Yes, yes. Because like I told you, when we first got to Springfield, I felt a very malevolent energy in that town. Now, I went to college in Joplin. That town has completely changed. It used to be the coolest town to hang out in. I don't know if I'd go there again, to be honest with you. After that whole hotel scene, I don't know if I'd ever go there. But I see the dead. I talked to the dead right after my uncle died many years ago. He came to me in my bedroom and told me some things. And he mentioned a couple of my current husband's family members. And we'd never talked about these family members because they'd been dead like 25, 30 years. So I mentioned their name, and he looked at me. And he said, "How'd you know his name?" I said, "Well, my uncle came to me last night and told me some things." And he just told me, he said, when he came to the bed, he said, "Don't worry about me, Debbie. I'm okay. I'm happy here." He said, "Your mom's up here. Your grandma's up here. We're happy up here. Don't worry about me." He said, "There are people out there that you think are your friends. They're not. You need to cut them loose." He said, because he was kind of fading in and out, and he said, "Tell your husband this person and this person said hello." And my husband had never discussed those people with me because, like I said, they've been dead a long time. But it has helped me evaluating people. There are some people, when I meet them, I have an instant repellent to them. There was a man the other day in the store that was so repulsive to me that I had to get away from him. I was in the market. And I couldn't get past his energy. Something told me, just look in the newspaper in this area. So I looked him up. He was on the sex offenders list. He was a violent rapist. He'd been out for a few years. But he still had that demonic, malevolent energy that just said, stay away. Completely stay away from him.
Were you able to identify those friends you were advised about?
Yes. Yes.
Was it correct?
Yeah, the one I think now looking back on it is an agent. Because there's too much of her life that's unexplained. She came to visit my spouse and I a couple of years ago, and she turned on me on a dime over something so silly and started saying real hit below the belt, hurtful things. And she stormed out of my house, and my spouse took her to the airport. And she was screaming and railing and ranting, and it was, I heard from people later, some of the things she said, it was just too painful. But that's one of the women my uncle mentioned when he came to me. He said, "Do not trust her. She pretends to like you, but she doesn't like you. She's a bad, bad person. She's very compromised." Another way, too, they get these gang stalkers, if they've got high student loan or credit card debt. The average American is carrying around $7,000 in credit card debt, maybe more. If you've got financial trouble, maybe you can't pay your credit card bill or you're nearing bankruptcy, you may be a target because they figure you'll sell your soul for a few shekels to pay off that credit card bill. But it always comes with a very heavy price because then it's like the mafia. You don't unjoin the mafia. Once you're in for life.
Shackles for shekels.
Yeah.
Getting back to your timeline for a minute, you moved from California to Florida. Is that correct?
Right, right.
Did the gang stalking continue?
Started the day after I got there.
About what year was this?
2011. I was in Florida about 2 days. My spouse was at work. I decided to go to the market, and I had someone follow me. And several different times in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'd had people follow me. I had a man follow me one day on the road who had like a magnet sign on the side. He was like an electrical contractor. And he almost hit my truck several times. It was quite obvious it was deliberate. So I just pulled over and I called the number on the side that was a corporate number. And I said, "Hi." I gave him my real name. I said, "Here's the license plate number of the car that your driver." "Yes, ma'am." He tried to run me off the road and he tried to ram into my car. I said, That is a bona fide assault, and that's an assault with a deadly weapon because it's a very heavy, big, heavy Chevy truck. I said, let me tell you something. I'm on to you. How's that sound? Okay, ma'am. Now, see, if this would have been a legitimate company, oh, what's his tag number? What does he look like? But that told me it was a front company. I said, I'm sick of you people. I know exactly what he's trying to do. Tell him to stay away from me. I'm not your typical TI. I fight back. Tell him to stay away from me. Never saw him again.
Excellent work, Debbie.
Then I had the sheriff stalking me for quite a while. He was big, tall, goofy-looking guy with glasses. And I would see him everywhere I went. Big, tall, white guy. I'd say he's probably 6'4". And I'm in a drugstore one day, and he just happens to stroll in. And he's bumbling around. He's very obvious. I mean, I wish they would teach them a course in being a little more discreet, because they're as obvious as a third eye on your face. And he's following me, looking, and I finally turned around, and I looked at him, and I said, hi. Hello there. I said, nice to see you again. No response. I said, you know, I really feel safe living in this county. I said, well, he said, why is that, ma'am? I said, because every time I'm somewhere, you're there. Isn't that funny? Well, that could be just a coincidence. I said, I don't think so. He got so flustered, whatever he picked up that he was going to buy, some innocuous object from the food aisle, he just threw it down and took off and left, and he walked out to his car. Thought I had everything in my car I was going to buy. So I walked up to the counter, and the young man that was working behind the counter was openly very gay. And he looked at me and goes, he's cute. I said, yes, he's very handsome. Well, he likes you, because he walked in and he was looking at you. And I said, yes, I know that. And so I pay for my stuff and I walk outside, and he's furiously typing on his laptop. And he's got his door open. I said, hi. Hello. I said, nice to see you again. And he said, nice to see you again. I said, you have a nice day. You too, ma'am. Then he shuts his door. So I get in my truck. I start up my engine. I turn around so I can deliberately have my passenger side right next to him. I said, see you again. Bye. Never saw him again.
These are really good interactions and good advice for others that are being targeted. If they have the courage to do what you're doing, this certainly puts a stop to most of the activity, most of the direct following.
Well, you always be friendly and nice, but mean what you say and look them in the eye, because they don't like eye contact, because they're such scumbags. They know deep down in their heart what they're doing is hurting people. But they're either on a being controlled, or they want the money. So I don't feel sorry for them. And I look them directly in the eye, but I'm friendly about it, and I act, you know, I play the dumb fox routine. Well, back then I was blonde, so I played the dumb blonde routine. And it usually pretty much stops them in their tracks, because they're not, like I said, they're not used to people looking them in the eye. They're used to the average docile American, and I hate to say that about our people, but it's the truth. We've been so beaten down, we have lost our spirit. And that's what they're betting on, is that Americans have lost their spirit. So with women play the sweet, dumb fox routine and then reel them in. With men, the less you say, the better. One or two words. But I like, you know, like when you see some of these really good actors, they only need to say one or two words, and they get their point across with their body language. So that's what my husband does. He just says one or two words, and they get what he's getting at. It's like I read between the lines kind of thing.
Shifting gears a little bit here, Debbie, as the mainstream media outlets open the floodgates right now in reporting about military investigations of UFO cases in the U.S., it's important to contextualize that for half a century, investigators have compiled abductee testimony that, when pulled together, reveal a startling reality. And in some cases of organized stalking, the motive is connected to the victims of abduction experience. It's common for government agents to stalk an abductee because of what they may know or share with the public. Debbie, if you would please share some of your abductee experiences with listeners.
It started in 1968 when I was 9. We were driving home from the grocery store, me and my mom and grandmother, my mother and grandmother both deceased, and my brother, he was 4 at the time. And we're driving down a cut-through road, because it's quicker to go from the one town to our house, And we went late shopping that night because it was a really hot night, like in June, because we were out of school, of course. And we're driving down this old road. It's paved, of course. And then all of a sudden, my grandma first saw something. She said, "What is that up in the sky?" So Mama slowed down a little bit, and I said, "Oh, that's really pretty." And it was pink and purple, and it was hovering right around the power lines. And my grandmother said, "That must be a new kind of airplane." All of a sudden, the car died. And that's the last thing I remember. And Mama had frozen ice cream back there and, you know, Breezy Pops and food to take home. And it would have spoiled if we were out there too long. My mother's like, "Oh, my God, what do we do now? The battery, the car won't start. You know, what am I going to do?" And boom, missing time. So 2 hours later, we're still on that road. And no one drove around. It's like time stopped. Mom starts the car and she goes, "Oh, my God, it started." Grandma said, "All that food's going to be ruined." So Mom gets out and pumps the truck. Amazingly, it was all still good. It was like it was frozen in time. It's like there was a giant refrigerator over the car. So we get the food home and unpack it. Maybe a week or two later, my four-year-old brother said, "There's a monster outside my bedroom." And he would refuse to sleep in the bedroom. He slept on the couch. He would refuse to sleep in the bedroom by the windows. And he would cry about it and cry about it. My mom would make him go back to bed. "I'm not sleeping in there. I'm very upset. There's a monster out to get me." Finally, my mother said, "Why don't you draw that monster to me?" "Well, why do you want that, Mom?" "I want to know what he looks like so that I can knock him over the head with a baseball bat and tell him to go away." So my brother just giggled. So a four-year-old draws a very rudimentary drawing. It was a great. And I remember the look on my mother and grandmother's face like, "Oh, my God." Then about 5 years later, we had moved to another town because the house that we lived in was beyond its repair. We had to move. So we moved to the town next over. It's a very small town like the one I grew up in. And Mama came home one night white as a sheet. Now, my mother's very fair-complected, so for her to be as white as a sheet, she was really scared. In fact, she asked if there was any alcohol in the house, and she wanted a shot of something. My mother's maybe had 5 drinks her entire life, so for her to have something to drink, something traumatic must have happened. So Grandma and I asked her, what happened? She said, "I'm driving down the road to home from work," because she worked a night shift, 3-11, and she said, "I could feel this big object flying over me." First, I thought it was a hawk or maybe like a large bird, but bald eagles are not really in that area. And she said, "It swooped about maybe 2 or 3 feet above my car, and I stopped dead in the road." She said it was about 6 foot tall, it had wings, and had red eyes. She said it scared her so bad she almost peed her pants. That's how bad it was. She flew home like a bat out of you-know-where, and after she took a sip of alcohol, she called the sheriff. And he told my mom, he said, "We've had 100 calls about that tonight. You're not the only one. We don't know what it is." I'm thinking now something let something out of the lab. And no harm, no foul. A few weeks later, my brother and I and my aunt were riding our bikes. Because back then, everybody rode their bikes all over the place. We're driving down the road, and there had been Bigfoot sightings in our area. And I know people are going to think I'm completely nuts, but there were Bigfoot sightings in our area. And a lot of people were spooked, that especially lived out in the woods, because they could see something out their back window. A lot of people back then didn't have screens in their windows. They couldn't afford it. And I could smell sulfur or rotting eggs. So we all stopped. And we turned around, and there it was in the woods, probably 20 feet away from us off the road. And my brother started screaming, because he was 8 at that time, "That's Bigfoot. I'm leaving." And he takes his bike, and he runs into the street on the highway, pedaling like a madman, crying all the way home. My aunt was petrified, and so was I. We were both more frozen than my brother just immediately darted off. And right after that, there were sightings about him all over, but I will never, never forget how he looked. He was probably 8 foot tall, brown color, and didn't have a malevolent energy about him, but it just freaked me out to see something like that as a 13-year-old. Then in March of 2017, it was close to St. Patty's Day, we were sitting in our den, and both of us immediately fell asleep. Now, prior to that, we had a bunch of missing time, different times, but I don't remember anything weird happening. So in March of 2017, we were sitting in our den, and we both just fell asleep. And the next day, I had this massive migraine headaches. Jeff, I never have migraines. I never have headaches. Never. And it was so bad, I felt like I'd been kicked and beaten. And for 2 days, my husband was very worried about me. And he even said, if you're not better by Monday, I'm taking you to urgent care. Because something has happened. Either you're having a stroke or you're having some kind of an embolism, but I'm worried about you. By Monday, it was okay. A few months later, I remember from just deep REM sleep and meditating, I remember being pulled out of our window. And when I could see the power lines. Like I said, I know people think I'm completely nuts, but this is exactly what I remember. And I remember seeing the moon. I don't remember saying anything after that, except for when we were all leaving. And there was about 300 of us on the dark side of the moon. And I remember a large tower with these bright, bright, bright lights and a craft taking us back to planet Earth. Because they can get back here in a pretty quick order. We're on the crafts, for lack of a better term. I don't know what they did to my spouse, but I do remember there was a woman on the craft, and I think it was a mass abduction of this area that night. There was a woman on the craft that I guess she was protesting being vaginally probed. And the gray got mad at her and whacked her on the head and knocked her over. There was an American military on that craft that was so upset that he did that because he knew the woman personally. He shot him and killed him dead with an M16. And they were going to court-martial him, but they decided not to because they were just going to erase his memory and send him back home, which is what they did. That could be some of the reason why there's so many military suicides, as they're going on these MLAB, MyLAB abduction scenarios, and they feel bad for what they've done. And they kill themselves because they can't live with what they've done. But I know that night, that weekend, Saturday and Sunday, because it happened on a Friday, that Saturday and Sunday, no painkillers took away that headache. Jeff, I had ice packs on my forehead. I had it on the back of my neck. I could sleep for about 2 or 3 hours at a time. I couldn't eat because I was physically ill. But it was only my head, so I was probably hit in the head too. I'm sure they just didn't do it to her. I'm sure they did it to me.
Right.
The last time they abducted us was probably a year ago. And I don't remember them doing anything weird. But I had a big scoop mark after the last abduction. I have a big scoop mark on the inside of my right ankle that was never there before.
Appreciate you sharing those experiences, and they sound really traumatic. It seems also these beings feel physical pain and can be killed by an assault weapon just like humans. So that's interesting.
Yes. I have read reports that some of them you have to decapitate them.
And I suspect that your knowledge of these experiences and sharing the information with other people might put you on the map in terms of being stalked and followed.
You know, I thought about this before we even talked on the phone. There's nothing I can do about what they do. I can only take care of me and my family, my spouse. We can only take care of each other. You don't tell very many people this stuff haven't told anybody this stuff except for my spouse and you, and now your listening audience, because they're just going to think you're crazy. Oh, well, she's just making that up. So even if I wrote a book about it, I'd have to just say it's fiction, because no one's going to believe you, or very few. The remnant's going to be very small who to believe you. Now, I will tell you, I had forgot this incident, and the first person I'd ever share this with was my husband. And I do believe we had a time travel incident when I was 14. And I will tell you about this. This was in rural Oklahoma. Halloween was always a big deal because it was a way to get free candy and to go out and do things without mom and dad, right? So two of my classmates, they had permits from driver's ed to drive. In fact, I don't think the one had a permit. He just drove anyway. We decided to go trick-or-treating, but we wanted to go to another area because we knew everybody in my hometown. We wanted to get some new stuff. I think it was a Saturday night. And we're driving, and all of a sudden we pull up, and there's this cul-de-sac, these really nice homes, but they look like they were built in like 1870. Friend said, let's stop here. I bet they got good candy. They look like rich people with nice homes. So we pulled up in the front of the house, and everybody was outside. Kids were dancing on the maypole, which I thought was kind of odd. And they all had period clothing of like 1880. I said, well, maybe they're just having a event for the Wild West, and they just want to dress up like, you know, over 100 years ago. So I didn't think anything of it. The first house we went into was all wood, had a wood-burning stove, and there was a woman in there with like a long sleeve shirt and a skirt, like they would wear back in the colonial times, with one of those little hats around her head, like a Betsy Ross type of hat. So we walked in. She said, "Would you kids like some candy?" I said, "Yeah." And she looked right at me and she goes, "Debbie, would you like some of these little muffins?" I said, "Okay." And I'm thinking, how did she know me? I've never seen this lady before. She's like 20 homes. And we had so much candy and baked goods that our bags were stuffed. So we finished and we were there about 2 hours. My one friend said, "I have to get home because if mom and dad know I'm out on this heathen pagan holiday, I'm going to get in big trouble." So the two guys dropped me off, and they both knew my grandmother and mom. So we come inside, and my grandma looks at that candy. She said, "I haven't seen those kind of muffins or scones since I was a kid," because my grandmother was born in 1912. "Where did you go?" So I told her the area, and her and mom looked kind of funny, and mom came in from the back room, and she said, "Where'd you go again?" I said, "I named off the street." She goes, "That street doesn't exist, Janet. That area was caught on fire like in the 1920s from a factory." I said, "You got to be kidding me." She goes, "No, everyone died in that fire. I can show you historical records." I didn't believe her. And my two classmates, the two men, had a funny look on their face and they left. So the next day they drove by there and that place didn't exist.
Ooh,
but we had the physical candy. And so did we go through a time slip? I don't know.
Debbie Johnson, I really appreciate you sharing these organized stalking events and the more paranormal events in your life with the listeners on this show. It's very valuable, and also giving some of the victims of organized stalking tactics in ways to protect themselves. I really appreciate this. Thank you so much for being on In Other News.
You're very welcome, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.